6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, everybody, where we are recording a bit of a special episode today because we have so much Q&A to get to, and Alex and I are on opposite are on opposite sides of the world, and finding a time to do this where we could both spend an hour together proved a bit tricky. So we thought we have so much Q&A to get to, and we kind of have different expertises anyway, so we would love to answer the questions that we feel are suitable for us today. And then, of course, we'll keep answering more next week when we are together again. I'm going to let Alex start us off, and then we'll move into my section of the questions. So over to Alex, and let's see if he has anything good to say, huh?
Okay, Dan, I'm going to jump right in with some Q&A. As you say, we have tons to get through, so I think it's great that we dedicate this full episode to answering the questions that you guys, the listeners, have asked. And again, there are many ways to get in touch with us, either via our own Instagrams, but what is even better is if you send a DM to the Instagram of the podcast, which is at On Air with Dan and Alex. And with that, I'll kick things off with a question from Hadi in Illinois. He says, "Hi, Alex, hope you're well. I have a question. How are certain ICAO or legal conventions named, such as the Geneva Convention, the Warsaw Convention, the Chicago Convention, etc.? Is this owing to the cities in which the treaties were written?" This poked my curiosity from the previous episode where we were discussing the Pakistan-India airspace issue. Hadi, you are correct. Typically, the convention, Geneva Convention, Warsaw Convention, all of these are the cities where the actual convention or the bit of legislation or the legal document, the framework, whatever that specific document is that they are signing, be it a treaty or stronger, is signed. That is the location whereby the signing ceremony or the states that are signatory to that document physically sign. It's not necessarily where the document or the piece of aviation agenda or legislative material was masterminded or thought up, or whereby the individuals who had proposed for that bit of legislation or that annexation are from, but actually it's specifically where the convention was signed. And sometimes it is to do with the convention. Sometimes there are links between the city that they end up signing in and what the bit of annexation or what the legal document was about. Sometimes there's absolutely no link. And so that's why typically in aviation, much like in many other industries, you have these declarations, you have these conventions that are named after those respective cities. In aviation, the most famous one is the Chicago Convention. And we have spoken about that in previous episodes. If you go back to some of the ones where I'm in Montreal at ICAO, we discuss kind of the prominence and how it actually factors in to global aviation and the likes of you and I being on board and the impact that those conventions have on our flights. So great question. Thank you, Hadi. I'll go to a question here from Priya in Mumbai. She says, "Hi, Alex and Dan. How much do airline CEOs in Europe actually make? As there is often a lot of buzz about what the take-home packages are for the big US carriers and their multi-million dollar take-home salaries. how does this compare to Europe? So this is a good question. We have discussed previously some of those huge packages that the likes of the US airline chiefs take home, as aviation is obviously an incredible moneymaker for the United States as a whole. But when you are speaking about private organizations chasing those big profits, it's the C-levels at the top of the US carriers that really take home a tremendous amount, at least in terms of what they're publishing on paper. And that's separate to the additions of things like bonus and everything like that when they are able to perform well. But let's go specifically to the question, how much do airline CEOs in Europe make? Well, the last bit of solid data, let's look at 2022 to 2023, and I'll give you at a glance. The CEO of Virgin Atlantic, his take home, his salary for that year was 4.3 million euros. That compares to the boss of Lufthansa Group, Carsten Spohr. He is almost the same, but at 4.2 million euros. And these are publicly shared documents. All of this is in the public domain. And this is something that they release typically with their financials. The CEO of Air France KLM, that's Ben Smith, again, almost identical and in line, taking home in that year 4.2 million euros. Then you look at the low-cost airlines and the likes of EasyJet, one of Europe's largest low-cost carriers. The CEO of EasyJet at the time, Mr. Lundgren, took home 3.5 million euros. So just a bit less than the likes of Lufthansa and Virgin. If we look at Ryanair, arguably one of the most prominent airlines in Europe, Michael O'Leary, very famous in aviation, super outspoken, you know, wants to charge people to use the lavatories and all that. His salary is just under 1 million euros. So they publicly disclose that his salary is 975,000 euros. Of course, that's much less than the likes of the salary of that year of the CEO of EasyJet, and then of course Lufthansa, Virgin Atlantic, and others. However, Michael O'Leary has shares in Ryanair worth 700 million euros. So the compensation there is coming in other ways. He is a prominent shareholder of an airline that he eats, sleeps, lives, breathes, and that is why his salary is on paper less. But as I say, those shares kind of bump up the final take home for him. Got a question here for this is from Max from Hamburg. Max says, hi guys, is the Lufthansa Group done expanding, or do you anticipate they'll still be buying up other airlines? This is a good one. So let's recap. The Lufthansa Group have just recently acquired ITA Airways, right? The kind of national carrier of Italy, used to be Alitalia, folded. ITA, ITA, was born, and they're doing pretty well. And now the acquisition has gone ahead. I know that they are still eyeing TAP Air Portugal. Many airlines are kind of swooping around the national airline of Portugal and figuring out what the fate will be there. Any airline that is financially sound and does not yet belong to a group like TAP Air Portugal is ultimately fair game, is attractive to the groups that rule Europe. And we're speaking about a heavily consolidated market. So in Europe, you've got IAG, that's British Airways, Iberia, Vueling, Level, Aer Lingus, and you have the Air France KLM group. You have, of course, the Lufthansa group that are really aggressive with their acquisitions. I would be surprised if we get to the end of the year and TAP Air Portugal is still a standalone carrier. I think that this is an airline that is incredibly attractive to all of those groups. Whether or not that means that Lufthansa will be able to swoop in and pick up TAP is a whole different story. And we saw, of course, what happened with Air Europa and IAG, and listeners to the podcast will know that there was millions spent on an attempt at an acquisition of Spain's Air Europa to kind of absorb it. They said they were going to keep the brand, IAG wanted it, and have it fly alongside Iberia. And the European Commission ruled against it in terms of the competition bureau, ultimately saying that it wasn't going to be in the interest of consumers. But there were a whole bunch of other factors as well that played, and ultimately IAG have given up and Air Europa is kind of back on the market. So I think Air Europa, we might see absorbed into another airline group, but everyone's a bit kind of digesting the repercussions of IAG's failed attempt. TAP Air Portugal, I think, is still kind of anyone's game. I have a question here from Felipe. He says, hello from Sao Paulo. LATAM's new business class looks really nice. Why doors now? This is a great question. So for anyone that hasn't seen, LATAM has unveiled the renderings of, and the seat, of the Thomson Vantage XL, but it's now coming with doors. So this is our latest business class. It's added privacy. It looks much like the suite products that are popping up at airlines all around the world now. And it looks smart. I would say specifically why doors now, it's just the airlines following the way air travel and premium air travel is now being angled and thrown globally. In many markets, passengers are demanding privacy. They want the opulence, they want the elevation of being able to close a door. Business class seats have turned from business class seats into business class suites. We discuss it here on the podcast a lot, and I would say that this is just the latest airline following that trend that really originally started back from Qatar Airways' Q Suite. When Q Suite debuted, the idea of a suite in business class wasn't something that was yet active in the market, and it was very closely followed by Singapore Airlines, and then suddenly it's now everywhere, and we have all of these business class seats that are now suites with doors being a key part of being able to offer passengers privacy. An anecdote that I've shared previously on the podcast is that British Airways, for so many years, of course, are famous for this yin-yang Club World product, right, where you have someone right there and then the barrier goes up. And for a long time, BA resisted, ultimately following the likes of the other big players, the Gulf carriers that lead and so on, the Asian carriers, in keeping a very open design for their premium business and first class cabins. When I'd spoken to British Airways designers about, if we're in 2025, no, it was about 8 years ago, they had told me that their customers want that interaction. They don't want to feel boxed in. They want the exposed cabin. They want to be able to chat to the passenger next to them, even if they didn't know them. I mean, I never bought that. I found that hard to believe. And that they wanted that kind of the eye contact from the crew as they pass through the aisle. Of course, if you've ever flown British Airways in a premium cabin long haul, you'll know that often they disappear after the first service. And so that was kind of their justification. And then, of course, at the same time as them justifying that, they were in the process of designing, manufacturing, and working on releasing what is now their Club Suite. And of course, it has a door, because they know that this is what passengers want. They want the option of privacy. They want to be able to sleep while nobody's watching. And this is just the general kind of trend, with LATAM now jumping on that, and understandably so. I've got a question here from Elias in Athens. He says, how are European airlines going to deal with summer air traffic control issues this year? So we see this every year, don't we? And arguably in 2022, we saw some of the worst air travel chaos in the summer, because it was that big bang return from the pandemic, and infrastructure just wasn't ready. Staffing levels were the lowest they'd ever been in the history of commercial aviation, and it was a complete mess. Each year since then, it's got a bit better. And last summer, things were pretty smooth on the whole. And we were really careful at declaring that the summer was smooth, because there was still, you know, a bit of summer left and it could have all gone wrong. And actually, it was fine. Understandably so, once again, Eurocontrol, who ultimately work with the skies of Europe, have warned that record 2025 summer traffic will once again cause complexities and potential disruption to air travel, because it doesn't leave much room for routine delays. And routine delays occur with things like air traffic control staffing shortages. It only takes two people to be off sick in a normal kind of sickness cycle for everything to then turn a little bit chaotic if they are reporting sick in either a navigation center or an air traffic control tower that is responsible to a key overflight area. There's also the industrial action that we expect all the time from France, of course. And this is something that the European airlines really hate because France is such a key overflight country that it affects, for example, flights between London and Cyprus, let's say, or even London and or the UK rather, and the Spanish islands, the Italian islands, the Sardinia, southern Italy. All of these flights are required to overfly France, and you get a bit of complexity there the moment they go on strike. The solution, I mean, I've spoken to several airline executives about how they're preparing for the summer, and depending on where these airlines are from, they'll answer you differently. For example, the airline chiefs that I've spoken to in the Gulf have said quite clearly that they're working on ensuring that their fleet is in a decent state, that they are ensuring that they are not going to face delays due to cabin air temperature, which is a big issue, for example, in the Gulf, when you have aircraft parking on a remote stand, the doors open, 50 degrees Celsius swoops into the cabin along with the humidity, and it takes a long time to lower that cabin temperature down to a temperature that is safe and legal for passengers to board for the next flight. So that can impact the time it takes to turn around an aircraft and thus have knock-on effects for the rest of the day. When you look at Europe, of course, their biggest concern often is to do with the air traffic controllers, staffing levels, the potential of strike action, and just the fact that there is record air traffic expected this summer, which is going to add pressure to an already constrained system, right? And so as a result, many airlines are having to buffer and pad out their schedules. That means not being as ambitious as they would have liked to have been, although this year's schedule is pretty ambitious for summer. And also it means padding the schedule a bit. So you might notice that, excuse me, on routes that are typically 2 hours and 15 minutes in terms of flying time, the airline, when you're booking the flight, is showing that your departure and your arrival time, the difference is 3 hours. Now, that doesn't mean that your flight is going to take 3 hours, but they are already gently telling you that your arrival time is 11:45. rather than 11, so that if there is, for example, 30 minutes worth of delays due to industrial action, due to air traffic control slots, due to the fact, or rather the lack of them, or just due to the, you know, the little bits in air travel and the congested skies that mean that weather, we have to space out aircraft and so on, there shouldn't be much impact on either their on-time performance or the time that you as passengers expect to have arrived anyway. So that's kind of that clever little way of padding things and reducing the noticeable impacts, both from an airline commercial perspective in terms of their on-time performance and for you guys as passengers. I've got a question here from Connor. Connor says, greetings from Dublin. What happens if Boeing delays its new aircraft even more? Is the silence something we should be reading into? This is a great question, Connor. We've spoken, of course, and everyone is very familiar with how delayed the likes of Boeing's 777X is, and also generally the other portfolio of Boeing aircraft. The question as to whether or not they're delayed even further is going to be a massive headache to carriers. But the airlines that I've spoken with that are in direct communication with the CEOs and the executives and the decision makers in Boeing tell me that Boeing is making progress. Slow but steady progress, and it is the best that they've seen Boeing in a long time. Now, I heard this from my kind of pool of airline CEOs that I text with, and just recently I saw this sentiment echoed by Michael O'Leary, Ryanair's CEO. Now, he is arguably one of Boeing's most prominent and largest customers, operating this humongous fleet of Boeing 737s. He's also one of the most outspoken critics of Boeing and will always use a little crisis in his favor to slam and hit Boeing in the media at any given time of their own struggle. He sat down for a recent interview and shared, interestingly, what I had heard from other airline chiefs, that he feels Boeing is in the best place it has been yet and that the outside world are not yet aware because they're fixing their own house before they then kind of make that declaration, we're ready to start delivering and to start performing. So things are, I mean, there's definitely light at the end of the tunnel. That's what the execs are telling me. Things are looking up there. But, and there is this big but, which is that the aircraft are ultimately still delayed. And there is no clear guidance on, for example, when or if Boeing are going to be able to deliver that flagship 777X in 2026 or not, what the impact is going to be on the ongoing Dreamliner delays, what's happening with the 737 MAX program, what about the fact that China are sending back all of the aircraft due to the tariffs and the complications presented by the current Trump administration, and so on. So they're not out of the deep end just yet, not by any means. And we're going to keep a close eye on it. What would further delivery delays mean? It would mean further difficulty and complication for airlines. I don't see it impacting fares, but the global economy is more likely to do that. But I know that airlines are feeling quite cautiously optimistic and positive. I wanted to say optimistic, cautiously optimistic and positive on the situation with Boeing and our friends in the US right now. Let's go to the next question I have from Thomas in Madrid. Thomas says, "Hi Alex, can we expect another major airline merger in Europe this year?" Well, I did kind of touch on this in terms of acquisitions, and I said, of course, that TAP Air Portugal is still the kind of likely next target. All of the big boys are interested. That's IAG, Lufthansa, and Air France KLM, as I said. Lisbon Hub being the prize. I think that with any merger and acquisition, following what happened with Air Europa, there will just be enormous scrutiny. So while I think that, yes, we will see further consolidation ahead, I just think that it will be under the microscope with an even greater level of intensity than what we saw with the Air Europa deal. And that is because standalone airlines are disappearing. And the European Commission is often trying to appear that it is working in the favor of European residents. So it's not going to be the easiest ride for any takeover, that's for sure. But will that stop airlines? No. Consolidation is key in Europe. It's not often in the interest of the consumer, but that doesn't stop the airlines from being able to swoop in and do that thing, especially in years where airlines are making incredibly remarkable profits as the 2024 to 2025 financial year is displaying, with many airlines coming forward now over the coming weeks, over the coming months, with some of their best financial results ever. And of course, they're looking to reinvest and reallocate these funds into even greater profits for next year. So that's takeovers and acquisitions are always on their radar. I've got a question here from Daniel, not my podcast host Daniel, but this is Daniel from Zurich. He says, "How long does it take usually to develop and roll out a brand new airline seat?" The quick answer is that if you're talking about a premium, maybe even a bespoke or a heavily customized premium cabin seat, like a business class seat or a first class seat, that's between 5 and 8 years, sometimes 10 years. And especially, I mean, a great example of this is Singapore Airlines. Singapore Airlines often unveil all of their new cabin products together. So I was at the last reveal in Singapore several years ago now, where they unveiled their new suites for the A380, their new business class, their new premium economy, and their new economy. That was all 10 years in the making from start to finish. Now that was about 10 years ago, and Singapore Airlines will soon be unveiling a fresh batch of suites, business class, premium, and economy. And by the time they unveil it, it will have been about 10 years since the last unveiling. So you see kind of the timelines that these big players, especially with four cabin classes, work on. Now, there are exemptions and exceptions to this, which is that many airlines are able to take catalog products. We've got all these big seat manufacturers, the likes that I was with in Hamburg that we spoke about a couple of episodes ago, and they're able to offer quick, faster to the market solutions that are in the catalog, and you just customize the furnishings, you tweak this, you tweak that, we want that armrest a little bit higher, we want that divider a bit more private, and so on. And they're able to get those products to the market much faster, which is helpful for newcomers like Riyadh Air, but also helpful for airlines who are trying to really quickly elevate what they have. Maybe they've had a dated product for a long time and they want to elevate quicker. That's the solution there. So it's not always as long as what it takes the likes of Singapore Airlines and those that really heavily customize their cabin products. I have a question from Antoine, and I believe Antoine is from Paris, because that's what it says on Antoine's Instagram. Antoine is asking, what is the most profitable cabin for airlines like British Airways, Singapore Airlines, and so on? I'll give you the quick answer. Typically, it's premium economy. Premium economy is an incredible moneymaker for airlines, ultimately because it has a lower footprint than business class and first class. It's cheaper to produce, it's cheaper to operate, but it has very high margins. And it is the one cabin globally that is consistently full, almost no matter what the airline is. The endless scenarios in terms of either marketing it as a solid premium economy and selling it as a premium product and it being a success, to the fact that many massive employers globally with staff shuttling around the earth are no longer allowed to immediately book business class, but are definitely allowed to book premium economy, to the fact that you can offer these minimal, you know, fee upgrades at the check-in desk for $150 to $200 and fill up that cabin. It is consistently the moneymaker for many airlines, including Singapore Airlines, as you had stated, and with business still being such a profit center, business class is costly ultimately to deliver, and that's where premium economy becomes more financially sound. So premium economy is the quick answer to your question, Antoine. I have a question here from Hiro. He says, what is the most profitable air travel route or examples of this? Well, let's think about this. I mean, pre-pandemic, and I think this would still be valid for today, and I'll just check your question that you're asking this. Yeah, so pre-pandemic, the world's only billion-dollar aircraft route in terms of revenue and also, but in terms of profit, the world's only billion-dollar airline route was between New York and London Heathrow, and I would say that that is still valid today, albeit we're missing some updated data. But the transatlantic route connecting London and New York is definitely, historically, the only billion-dollar air travel route. This was a billion-dollar air travel route for British Airways alone. So that's not taking into consideration all of the other airlines that fly that route. That was just for BA. And you can understand why. You are connecting two very premium heavy financial hubs. You are having the back and forth of everyone on the business side of things, financiers, bankers, executives, diplomats, and so on. But also it's really heavy with premium leisure as well. And they're just two very prominent cities, aren't they? London and New York. And unsurprisingly, there is immense premium demand that is really driving up the profits there, in order to ensure that it has become the world's only billion-dollar route. Final question from my side, Dan. I've got a question here from Ahmed in Muscat, Oman, beautiful part of the world. Ahmed is asking, what travel markets will be strong in summer 2025? Summer 2025, in terms of travel markets, kind of similar picture to last year. Spain doing very well, Greece and Italy too, all expected to boom again. You've got that white lotus effect still playing down with Sicily and all of the carriers in the US that are launching nonstop flights there. Japan and Korea continue to show great results in terms of visitor numbers and how that translates into flight tickets and hotel bookings and so on. Japan really having its moment over the last year in terms of global attraction and more people traveling to Japan for the first time than in any other time of history, which is really interesting. Saudi Arabia, of course, doing very well, especially with that sporting season and all of the big names that they're attracting there. And then Africa to Europe is picking up for continental Africa over to Europe. Airlines are adding or increasing capacity there, specifically for flights to the likes of Brussels, but also London, and then people taking their journeys elsewhere from those respective hubs. India to the Gulf also doing very well recently. That's always a stable and safe bet in terms of performance. There is that flow. And then, of course, in the summer, who can forget Australia, right? And the fact that the kangaroo route thrives with Australians having that Euro summer, but also the sheer number of Europeans or those of European heritage residing, born, raised in Australia, that then go back and spend time with their families in Europe, driving up the visiting friends and relative market on the all-prized kangaroo route, which we did a great episode on recently that I would encourage you all to go and watch, because we really kind of went into the detail of the prominence of that route. I think we were discussing the kangaroo while we were in Singapore. Yes, that was correct. We were in the studio. So yeah, that's the Q&A from my side. Feel free to send in many of your questions, as I said, to our shared Instagram.
Okay, hello again, guys. I just want to send a quick reminder here. If you watched my latest video on YouTube, either on Oscar and Dan or on Nonstop Dan, you might have heard that if you go to nonstopdan.com/hotels, you can now get luxury perks when booking 5-star hotels all around the world. So whether you like Four Seasons, Marriott's luxury brands, Hyatt's luxury brands, Hilton's luxury brands, Rosewood, Shangri-La, so many more, you can now get things like a $100 property credit, early check-in, late check-out. Sometimes I say that wrong. You can get free breakfast, space available, upgrades, all types of stuff like that by booking at nonstopdan.com/hotels. So check it out if you have a luxury hotel stay coming up, because you will pay the same price you pay directly through the hotel, but get all these additional perks for free and be supporting me and the podcast. So let's dive right into it. Philip asks, first of all, in July, he is flying Lufthansa Allegris business class to Shanghai with a partner. What would be my preferred seat if I was flying Lufthansa Allegris? My preferred seat is not paying for a seat. That's the first thing. So how would that work? Well, I think you should select the free seats if you can. If those are taken, wait, because Lufthansa needs to automatically assign you some kind of seat, right? So actually, scrap what I said first. Do not select seats yet, because the free seats will be taken and then they will be forced to give you a premium seat for free. The best thing is when online check-in opens, or in my case, when online check-in opened, why is that hard to say? When online check-in opened, the business suites were not available for free, but I know they are for some people. In my case, I had to go to the airport, and when I was checking in there, they were still available and I could get them for free. So I didn't have to pay extra. Most of those seats were not pre-assigned, which meant that I could get a business suite for free. And I think if you're traveling with your partner, the business suites in the middle, if you can get those for free, that would be the absolute best place you could sit, because those seats are actually really, really awesome. So let's see here. Another question here from Xander. He says, to comment on Dan's most recent Lufthansa improvements video, which was very enjoyable to make, guys. And if you listen to On Air, I think you would actually love that video. So go check it out. He asks, would both of you ever consider making a video or just spending an hour on the podcast grilling an airline? Well, we love to grill airlines. I don't know if all of it should be said on air, but definitely if we have any on-air meetups or that kind of thing, we will be very happy to grill airlines. But I think we are quite critical on here. It doesn't feel too professional to spend a whole hour grilling an airline, right? So let's see. Omer asks, topics for discussion or thought. Gulf Air starting service to New York this summer. This is not 100% confirmed yet, and given that we're saying this summer, I doubt that. We will mark this as developing, and when the flights are on sale, we will, of course, discuss it more. Gulf Air is, of course, the original Gulf airline. If you didn't know that, before the likes of Emirates, before the likes of Qatar Airways, Gulf Air was the main airline for the whole region. They weren't only based in Bahrain, but they operated service between many Gulf countries and between the Gulf and the rest of the world. So when things changed, Gulf Air really, they've been forced to shrink and rethink their strategy a lot, especially now that they have such tough competition in the region. And the furthest they've flown at this point is London to the west and Manila to the east. So New York would certainly be a really exciting development. Let's see what else we have here. So Daniel asks us, so he's a huge fan of the podcast, hasn't missed an episode yet. That's awesome. An American LCC, low-cost carrier. I keep wanting to say LLC, which this is not. Actually, maybe it is also. Anyway, Avelo has taken on a contract with the U.S. government to perform deportation flights. I'm kind of shocked that a commercial airline would take on such a controversial contract. I've looked up to see if this is a common practice, and it really isn't. It's mostly charter airlines taking on contracts like these. I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. So this is pretty interesting. Right now, or for the past few years, there's been an airline, Global X is their name, and they were supposed to launch as a charter airline as well, but they've pretty much only ended up chartering deportation flights. So I think the cabin crew were marketed being able to, you know, operate charter flights for celebrities, sports teams, people that they were huge fans of, and instead they ended up basically operating flights for people in shackles to the likes of Venezuela or Central America. And I can't speak for Avelo in this case, but I know that in the case of Global X, the flight attendants have had huge issues with this. Obviously, so think about many of the people being deported are in shackles and their hands are shackled to their legs or to their feet. So they cannot run and they cannot escape the aircraft in the case of an evacuation. Flight attendants are trained that they are not supposed to leave the aircraft in an emergency until every last passenger has left. So what does that mean when people are shackled and can't really evacuate? That's a tricky situation. And there have been some scenarios we've seen, and you know, an aircraft is supposed to be able to be evacuated very quickly. There's laws on this, but I remember that I'm just pulling this out of my head. I think there was an evacuation of a deportation flight. No, there was. But I think the time that it took to evacuate everyone that was being deported was 9 minutes, which is obviously an unacceptable amount of time. And it poses a huge safety risk, not only to the flight crew, but to everyone on board and to the deportation officers. So I think it's weird for an airline that also serves passengers to get involved with this. I feel bad for their crew, and yeah, not the best news in my opinion. So let's see here. Wow, you guys are sharing some nice videos with us. Actually, loads of videos, so thank you for that. Let's see here. Olena says, hi, Dan and Alex. Love the podcast. I listen every week on my way to uni. I have a question about visa entry into the US. I know you already touched on it a few weeks ago, but my situation is that I'm a US citizen with an additional German passport, and I live in Germany with my boyfriend. He, however, has a German passport and a B2 visa valid for 10 years with up to 6 months visiting at a time allowed. For the US, which he uses every summer to go visit my family back in California with me, which is usually a 4-week stay. 4 weeks in California sounds absolutely amazing. I'm jealous. I'm getting more and more worried about if he should even come this summer, since if something were to go wrong, he would most likely end up having issues getting another visa in the future. Other than flying through Dublin, do you have any recommendations or thoughts on this situation? Olena, I relate to you 100%. I have the exact same concerns with my partner, Oscar. And what a scary, crazy time that we have to worry about this kind of stuff with the US, right? Honestly, you've heard us talk about this before, where some immigration lawyers say, bring a burner phone, don't have anything critical of Trump on your device, which I think is absolute craziness, and I'm not going to buy a burner phone for me or for Oscar to visit the US. I think besides going through Dublin or Abu Dhabi, which will be the most effective thing and avoid you getting detained and deported, because then at least you get to stay in Ireland. Some other important things to think about would be just that he's very clear, for example, because we've seen some stories about this, that he is 100% on vacation. He does not plan to work in the US. Also, make sure there's no confusion about his previous visa situations. If he's had any other US visas, like a student visa, for example, just make sure the visa situation is clear. He hasn't maybe visited any sketchy countries that are visible in his passport and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, I'm not more of an expert on this, but that's what what we plan on doing when Oscar and I go eventually. Michael says, love the podcast. Question for you. Do you think the Al Safwa First Class Lounge or Doha Airport is worth purposefully extending your layover from 2 hours to 6.5 hours? First time to Doha and headed to Oman. Very excited. Thanks. Well, thank goodness Alex is not here, because he would have a very clear answer to this. He would say, yes, of course. My answer is this. It depends if you think you'll be back to Doha anytime soon, because yes, it's a great airport. The Al Safwa Lounge is awesome. But I've said this a lot of times, besides admiring the architecture, which you can do very quickly by walking. First of all, you walk through Al Safwa. Then you go out in the airport, you walk to the orchard, you see all the beautiful stuff. If you're not someone who necessarily wants to try everything on the menu or take a nap, which you probably can't do in 6.5 hours anyway, get a nap room, then, you know, I would say 6.5 hours is actually a lot of time to kill, even in a lounge like Al Safwa. But if you want to use the jacuzzi, if you want the food, and if you want time to explore every inch of the airport, look in stores and stuff, 6.5 hours would actually be a sort of perfect amount of time to do that. So I guess I'm just spoiled because I'm lucky to go a lot. So I don't necessarily feel like for me or for someone else, we would need to extend the stay that much. Oscar tunes in and says, this is not my Oscar, another Oscar. He says, this is not a question, but an agreement. I recently did a trip to Thailand from Sydney and had a leg on Scoot from Singapore to Koh Samui at 7 a.m. Cool, you got to fly their new Embraers. I found Terminal 1 to be very disappointing with that only food court to be open upstairs, but had limited options and all chairs were full and it was dark and poorly lit with only the 3 cafes or so. In the end, I went to 7-Eleven for a drink and that's it, and sat on the floor by the window. I had no idea about the entrance to T2, as I had a lot of spare time. A total contrast to T3. Plus, since I was flying on Scoot, even with SQPPS status, I could not access lounge. So it damaged my opinion on Changi, and Hong Kong is much better and is the best airport in the world. So I completely agree with your comments earlier. Always love your work. Thank you, Oscar. Interesting, very interesting. Because, yeah, you guys heard Singapore Changi Terminal 1 is not our favorite. And I know some of you guys actually DM'd us that they just posted a video, maybe today or a few days ago, about the amazing things to do in Changi Terminal 1. And let's be honest, the things they showed in that video, if you go to Changi Airport's Instagram, do not address what we were talking about, okay? The lack of food options, the lack of grab and go, we did not find that. And apparently Changi Airport did not either, because I think the one restaurant they showed was landside, not airside, which is obviously where we were. So here we go. Jeremy asks, final question for today. What do you guys think about the potential of the now complete Alaska and Hawaiian merger? Specifically, could there be possibilities for greater one world connectivity in the Pacific from North America, since American has pulled back from trans-Pacific routes? I am so excited about this merger. It merges two very unique and powerful brands in the US, definitely some of the best airlines in the US. And I like that they're maintaining the individuality of both companies. So they're not going to just become Alaska or just become Hawaiian, but they will remain separate, which I think is good because they offer such different experiences, but both are good in their own way. Of course, we know that Alaska is actually launching long-haul flights out of Seattle later this year. So very soon we're going to see flights to Asia. I think the first route is Seoul, but don't quote me on that. I don't know to what extent we will see a massive trans-Pacific network out of Seattle. We'll see. I think these first few routes will be a test to see how they perform, if Alaska can compete, because in economy, of course, they'll be competing on price, but in premium cabins, they'll be competing with Delta, which has a really loyal following for their Delta One product. Don't ask us why, but they have a huge fan base. So I think Alaska needs to find a solid way to compete with that. And their current aircraft that they'll be sending to Asia, the Hawaiian A330, is not really a great way to compete with Delta One. Even I would definitely choose Delta One over that because we're talking 222 business class, which is just not competitive anymore unless you're flying to a leisure destination like Hawaii. So Alaska will need to invest a lot in the Trans-Pacific premium experience, which I believe they can, I believe in Alaska. And at that point, you know, now the Chinese airlines still have a greatly scaled back market to the US, meaning the fares are much higher than they were pre-pandemic, and award space is much worse as a result of that, which is a huge bummer. I think that Alaska could have huge success, especially on routes to Japan, to South Korea, hopefully, and maybe Taiwan. China is kind of tricky, especially given the bilateral agreements don't allow that many flights. So we will see, but I am hopeful. And you know that both Alex and I are One World guys. We think it's the strongest alliance in terms of benefits, elite recognition. And this is great news. So on that note, guys, thank you for joining us this week on air. We cannot wait to see you next week for a normal episode where I'm not just sitting here like it was any old nonstop damn video. And we will see you then.
It's been a pleasure. Looking forward to joining you, Dan, for our live episode next week. And thank you guys for watching as always. See you later.
Bye-bye.
Now at Menards, save big on everything for your landscaping project. Whether you're shopping for edgers, pavers, or wall blocks, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Plus, get fast free estimates when you use our landscape design program available in-store and on Menards.com. Save big on landscape blocks when you shop at Menards. Also, check out the great deals from our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.